Just call me Blewett. But my first name is Hammett, but I don't use it that much anymore.
Many of us have musical memories we'll never forget. One of mine is of the Sam Rivers Big Band at Orchestra Hall in Minneapolis in the 1980s. That evening, Rivers led a stellar ensemble with some of the best players around. Bassist Rufus Reed and Dave Holland, drummer Michael Carvin, and besides himself on tenor saxophone, Chico Freeman. Each of them performed powerful solos, but none more so than Hammett Blewett on baritone saxophone. Let me set the stage for you. Built in 1974, Orchestra Hall's very modern interior features more than 100 huge white cubes protruding from the ceiling, and most prominently, from the back wall of the stage. These massive falling rocks serve to diffuse the sound throughout the room like the florid decorative elements found in European concert halls of old. Man, did Blewett take advantage of those acoustics that night. Dressed in a pure white suit, he took his unaccompanied solo by purposefully walking the perimeter of the stage, honking and screeching on a step or two, and then listening like a tone scientist to the sound reverberate in the cavernous space. The combined oral and visual effect was both musically and socio-politically profound. Here was an African-American jazz musician from Lovejoy, Illinois, bringing his music into one of the bastions of Euro-American culture in a way that said, in the words of Jesse Jackson, "I am somebody." Interestingly, one of Jackson's advisors has said that on long airplane trips, Jackson would listen to jazz on a set of headphones and come up with lines for his speeches in a process he called Jacksonizing. But Blewett does a lot more than honk and screech. Listening to Blewett and pianist Larry Willis play Thelonious Monk's Ask Me Now from their 1999 CD, If Trees Could Talk, on the Mapleshade label. Before that, we heard Blewett with Asante on percussion on The African from the same CD. I asked Blewett why he chose to play the baritone saxophone.
I saw a baritone when I was about maybe 9, 8, I don't remember. I had always wanted to play saxophone, so it was just like love at first sight. It took me to get to about 18, I guess, before I finally got to one. But that's the one I wanted to play. I never wanted to play alto or tenor or anything else. I just liked the way it looked.
As he said, it would be a while before Blewett and the Berry got together.
Because at the time, I come from a small village, so there were no more saxophones, so they put me on clarinet. Saxophone was already been taken. One of the three. As a foundation for the Reed family, so I played that until I finally got a baritone. I was about 18, I think, something like that.
As a musician with a long-time commitment to the baritone saxophone, Blewett has some criticism to offer to both Reed players who might occasionally double on Barry, and to some composers.
Most people play the horn, don't take the time to really play it. They need a job for somebody playing baritone, they pull it out of the drawer and go make the job. But they never really investigate to find out what it really does. What it really does is totally different from what everybody writes for. They write for it like it's a violin, not a violin, a cello. Whatever tends to write for like it's a violin, all kinds of stuff. But not a saxophone. And not a baritone saxophone, it's a different voice. It's not a trombone. I mean, you can make it do, you know, because most of the stuff is coming off a pianistic concept. I mean, you know, the horn can play out of tune, in tune, a lot of different things that a fixed instrument can't do, so it's kind of unfair to look at it that way. It's a baritone, it's not a bass. It's used a lot of functions as a bass, where it's really a baritone. So the power of the sound is not really, it's not in its power zone, in its powerhouse, just in terms of how music is.
All of the music we've heard so far was recorded at Mapleshade Studio, which is housed in a century-old plantation-style mansion in Upper Marlboro, Maryland. Here Blewett switches to alto flute in a free improvisation titled If Trees Could Talk, after the opening lines of a Washington Post interview with him conducted by Marianne French. If trees could talk, they could tell us how human life is captured, controlled, possessed. They've seen it all. Later in that interview, Blewett talked about the conflict he felt as an African-American recording on the site of a former tobacco plantation with its historical connections to slavery. On Runaway, the last piece on the album, Blewett plays it like it is, outside, on the front porch of the mansion. Blewett is perhaps best known for co-founding the World Saxophone Quartet in 1976 with David Murray, Oliver Lake, and the late Julius Hemphill. Here on a Just in Time recording, he provides the foundation for an arrangement of the Jimi Hendrix version of Hey Joe. I asked him how the World Saxophone Quartet came to be.
We started out mainly as an extension of what was going on in the loft, in the yard. I mean, the developer, though, because we didn't have no engineers or A&R man. Or somebody sitting around telling you, well, that's where the, what's where, that's the bottom line, or that's what, you know, all that kind of talk, whatever it is, about what you should do, what you got to do. So just, you know, it's kind of just doing what we as musicians do. So the group was formed that way. So it's a good way to be formed.
At the time, their approach was unique.
And we knew how to play without a rhythm section. So that's the main sort of invention, if you want to call it that, that we came up with. You know, of having a rhythm section in this group that could really had a pulsation that could swing to everything. You didn't miss nothing. It was a whole band. So, but in order to do that, we had to lose all this other way of thinking. You know, come up with something new and different. And let the saxophone be a saxophone.
While still letting saxophones be saxophones, in recent years the quartet has sometimes expanded into a larger group. On this year's Political Blues, the change is apparent. Childhood in 1940s Lovejoy, Illinois, to co-founding the Black Artist Group in 1968 in St. Louis, to his work in New York City and beyond, Blewett has always blazed his own path.
In my lifetime, I'm doing what I do and not following everybody else. So I feel real good about my accomplishments. You know, I don't have an accomplishment because somebody else did it and I followed them. Not really. I mean, no one is the first, but I didn't clone anyone or whatever, you know. The instrument wouldn't let me do that. That's another reason why I picked it. I knew I'd have to go my own way.
In Los Angeles, for Notes from the Western Edge, I'm Richard Paskey.
I've got political blues, sick of hearing it every day. I've got the political blues. Katrina broke the levee.
Won't you believe? All my words. Won't you believe?
I'm going to try to reconstitute a relationship to dance music with a contemporary generation and then introduce forms that are post-bop, bop, free, or whatever within that platform.
Won't you believe?
In life.
Cahil El-Zabar was born in Chicago, not in 1941 like in the song, but in 1953. He grew up on the South Side, where he heard its music every day on the streets. Doo-wop, blues, gospel, R&B and jazz. Music was in his family, too.
My father was a big jazz fan and an amateur drummer, and he was actually introduced to my mom by her brother, who was a professional drummer named Leroy Finch, Leroy Candy Finch. And he had worked with Bird and Fats Navarro and a whole bunch of people. And ended up over the years working with Gene Ammons.
Kids in the neighborhood were into the music too.
A guy named Chico Freeman, his father was Vaughn Freeman, so I grew up around Vaughn and George Freeman, his brother, and all these folks, and so it seemed to be a way of life and something that I was very proud of. From the heart. In life. When I was a little kid, I used to scat with my father and stuff, and he'd go through the tunes, and I didn't know how vital that would be to the way that I approach music today. When I was a teenager, you know, I was taken to all the clubs around Chicago, and, you know, I was lucky enough to hear Train live and Monk and all kinds of people that I think, you know, was instilled in me. And, you know, by the time I was a teenager, I was working with Moo Hall and Gene Ammons and Eddie Harris and all those folks.
We're listening to Our Time Is Now by El Zabar and Kemet Sources, remixed by IG Culture from Deeper Soul Remix Project, a new release on Chicago's Deeper Soul Recordings. El Zabar is heard here on vocals. The album is proof that at age 54, El Zabar has been discovered by a younger generation.
Our time is now.
In my father's house, I have heard the words. In life. In my father's house, In life. I have heard the wisdom in life. I have heard the wisdom in life. In my father's house.
About these new directions later. Now let's listen to some Roots.
You know, I studied from childhood, you know, with folks like Steve McCall, you know, in terms of, you know, playing drums, and my uncle Leroy, and then, you know, percussionists like Master Henry Gibson. They played with Curtis Mayfield and a whole bunch of folks, and Harold Atu Murray, that worked a lot with Big Black in New York. It was like my main teachers. Harold was more of my African percussionist teacher, and Master Henry Gibson was more of my Latin or conga, you know, teacher, because they're very different styles. And then people start calling on me for doing those different things, either playing congas or playing African percussion or playing traps.
While still a teenager, El Zabar started doing gigs as a drummer with musicians like Gene Ammons, Eddie Harris, Nina Simone, and Cannonball Adderley. He crossed over to the pop side as well, with musicians like Stevie Wonder and Paul Simon. But jazz had a hold of his soul, so much so that he quit Simon's band just to play once a week with the co-founder of the Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians, Richard Muhal Abrams.
So here I am, you know, 20 years old, this gig with Paul Simon making $1,500 a week, you know. It's a lot of money, you know, for a 20-year-old kid. You know, that's like making $5,000 a week today. But then what everybody was telling me on the street was I was with the real geniuses. You know, I was like, Sundays I had the opportunity to be with Moo Hall. I was playing percussion, Steve McCall was playing drums, you know, Rufus Reed is playing bass, Thre Gill on saxophone, Wallace McMillan on saxophone, you know, and sometimes George, you know, George was starting his first year at Yale. You know, and they said, man, you went to like geniuses, you know. And I quit Paul Simon just to be able to do that gig on Sunday, you know. And I remember my father saying, couldn't you have done both of them? You know, but you know, you're young and, you know, I wanted to connect and be, you know, in that moment, you know, in that inspiration and stuff. And so then
his focus intensified on the kind of AACM musical dialectics practiced by Abrams, Henry Threadgill, George Lewis, and others.
Here's a whole new pedagogy of music, which is outside of time predominantly, and understanding the precepts and perspectives of pulse beyond time. Like, you know, like, what is this? You know, so, you know, so each of the various schools and the camps of musicians had so much richness and diversity in their approach and their dynamics. And, you know, the thing that I think probably my most important lesson from the association was conceptualization. I knew many virtuosos, you know, very skillful technicians on their instruments, and very emotionally impacting players. But what made the difference for me in my life and my development was being a conceptualist. That I can conceive structures and forms and looking at ideas to interpret those forms. And that's allowed me to have Ritual Trio, Ethnic Heritage Ensemble, my large orchestra project, Orchestra Infinity, my dance music project, Juba Collective.
We've been listening to Cow from Big M, a tribute to Malachi Favors, a 2006 release on Delmark Records, with Elzebar on drums, Yosef Ben Israel on bass, Ari Brown on saxophone, and Billy Bang on violin. Before we listen to the Juba Music Collective, which leads us back to where we started with the remix project, let's listen to some of the title track dedicated to the original bass player in Elzebar's Ritual Trio, Malachi Favors. Favors was for Elzebar not just the bass player in his band, but also a mentor and a friend. He passed on January 30th, 2004. Elzebar, music is universal, not just sound, but lifestyle, philosophy, activity, endeavor. In 2002, his joined Universal Breath Ascending, Juba Collective, reached out to a younger generation of listeners by mixing jazz forms with contemporary dance rhythms, much like Miles Davis did in 1969 with Bitches Brew. Elzebar's message stretches back thousands of years, through Chicago, Kansas City, Mississippi, and ultimately back to Africa, ancient to the future.
I did work with Dizzy. I did work with Cannonball. I was with Jug, you know, when I was 17 and 18 years. So that's in me. That's going to come out. I work with all the so-called, you know, masters of the AACM. I have been at this for over 36 years. And when you're with a person 18 and 19 and you want to translate what it was to be in the company of Dizzy Gillespie, the life experience, not just being on the bandstand, but the conversations and all that, that's what went on in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. And I believe why young people are reaching back to classic R&B or classic so-called jazz or whatever is because of that authenticity that now folks our age have to take the responsibility to embrace and not turn a person off, not isolate, not be a bohemian hermit that says, I'm protecting my essence by disassociation. I can't be that person. I need to be out there. And you can't create a Miles Davis, a Chet Baker, a Dizzy Gillespie, a Marvin Gaye, Jelly Roll Morton if you can't translate lifestyle. You could never have had a Charlie Parker unless there was a Kansas City and there was a lifestyle that permeated the inspiration of the genius.
Lifestyle, inspiration, genius. Living cultural artifacts emanating from the African-American heritage that gave birth to Cahil El-Zabar. In Los Angeles, for Notes from the Western Edge, I'm Richard Paskey.